As the master of the Mayflower, Jones was not required to assist the pilgrims in their attempts to find a settlement site, but he obviously thought it in his best interests to see them on their way. There were 34 of them, 24 passengers, and 10 sailors aboard the open shallop. The wind was out of the northeast, and the shallop had a difficult time weathering the point within which the Mayflower was anchored. After being blown to the opposite side of the harbor, they spent the night tucked into an inlet that is now part of Pilgrim Lake. The tidal flats along the shore were becoming more than just a nuisance. As the temperatures dipped to well below freezing, their wet shoes and stockings began to freeze. "Some of our people that are dead," Bradford wrote, "took the original of their death here." Cape Cod is well to the south of England. Indeed, the Cape is about the same latitude as Madrid, Spain. But so far they had experienced temperatures that were much colder than back home. As they soon discovered, New England has a very different climate from England. Weather along the eastern seaboard of North America usually comes from the continent to the west, while in England it comes from the Atlantic Ocean. Since land absorbs and releases heat much more quickly than water, New England tends to be colder in the winter and hotter in the summer than England. Adding to the disparity between American and English winters is the Gulf Stream, which continually warms the British Isles. But in 1620, there was yet another factor at work. North America was in the midst of what climatologists have called the Little Ice Age, a period of exceptional cold that persisted well into the 18th century. As a result, the pilgrims were experiencing temperatures that were cold even by modern standards in New England, and they were more than a month away from finding a place to live. By morning, there were 6 inches of snow on the ground. By the time they'd sailed south back to Pamet Harbor in modern Truro, they were so frostbitten and numb that they had no choice but to name the inlet Cold Harbor. Jones decided to explore the northern and largest of the two creeks by land, but after several hours of marching up and down the steep hills and deep valleys, which lay half a foot thick with snow, the master of the Mayflower had had enough. At 50 years old, he was most certainly the eldest of the group. Some of the pilgrims, perhaps led by the recently demoted Standish, wanted to continue, but Jones insisted it was time to make camp under several large pine trees. That night, they feasted on 6 ducks and 3 geese, with soldiers' stomachs, for we had eaten little all that day. Cold Harbor, it was decided, was too shallow to support a permanent settlement. Giving up on any further exploration of the two creeks, they went looking for Corn Hill the next morning. The snow made it difficult to find the stores of buried corn, but after brushing aside the drifts and hacking at the frozen topsoil with their cutlasses, they located not only the original bag of seed, but an additional cache of 10 bushels. For Master Jones, this was just the excuse he needed to return to the warmth of the Mayflower's cabin. He must get the corn, along with several men who were too sick to continue on, back to the ship. Once the corn and the invalids had been loaded aboard the shallop, he set sail for Provincetown Harbor. The boat would return the next day for the rest of them. Standish was once again in charge. The next morning, he led the 18 remaining men on a search for Indians. But after several hours of tramping through the woods and snow, they had found nothing. The Native Americans' seasonal settlement pattern, inland in the winter, near the water in the summer, meant that the pilgrims, who were staying for the most part near the shore, were unlikely to encounter many Indians during their explorations of Cape Cod. On their way back to the harbor, not far from where they had come across some burial sites the week before, Standish and his men found a place like a grave, but it was much bigger and longer than any we had yet seen. Only the week before they decided it was wrong to violate the Indians' graves. This time they could not help themselves. There were boards positioned over the grave, suggesting that someone of importance had been buried here. They resolved to dig it up. They found several additional boards and a mat made of woven grass. One of the boards was finely carved and painted with 3 tines on the top like a crown. This may have been a carving of Poseidon's trident, suggesting that the board originally came from a ship, most probably the French ship that had wrecked on this coast in 1615. Farther down they found a new mat wrapped around two bundles, one large and one small. They opened the larger bundle first. The contents were covered with a fine, sweet-smelling reddish powder, red ochre used by the Indians as both a pigment and an embalmment. Along with some bones, they found the skull of a man with fine yellow hair still on it, and some of the flesh unconsumed. With the skull was a sailor's canvas bag, containing a knife and sewing needle. Then they turned to the smaller bundle. Inside were the skull and bones of a small child, along with a tiny wooden bow and some other odd knacks. Was this a castaway from the French ship and his Indian son? Had this particular sailor been embraced by the local Indians and died among them as a person of some special note? Or had the Indians killed and buried the sailor in triumph over him? They had left Holland so that they could reclaim their English ancestry. But here was troubling evidence that America was no blank slate. There were others here who must be taken into account. Otherwise, they might share the fate of this yellow-haired sailor whose bones and possessions had been left to molder in the sand. Later that day, just a short distance from Cold Harbor, Standish and his men found some Indian houses whose occupants had clearly left in a great hurry. The description of what they found, recorded in a brief book about their first year in America, co-written by Bradford and Edward Winslow, is so detailed that it remains one of the best first-person accounts of an Indian wigwam, or wetu, that we have. Indeed, a modern anthropologist, transported back to November in 1620, would have a difficult time outdoing the report left by two cold, sick, and exhausted English emigres who were far more familiar with the urban centers of Europe than the wilds of America. The houses were made with long, young sapling trees, bended and both ends stuck into the ground. They were made round like unto an arbor, and covered down to the ground with thick and well-wrought mats. And the door was not over a yard high, made of a mat to open. The chimney was a wide-open hole in the top, for which they had a mat to cover it close when they pleased. One might stand and go upright in them. In the midst of them were four little trenches, that is, Y-shaped stakes, knocked into the ground, and small sticks laid over on which they hung their pots. Round about the fire they lay on mats, which are their beds. The houses were double-matted, for as they were matted without, so were they within, with newer and fairer mats. Among the Indians' clay pots, wooden bowls, and reed baskets, was an iron bucket from Europe that was missing a handle. There were several deer heads, one of which was still quite fresh, as well as a piece of broiled herring. As they had done with the graves of the blond-haired sailor and Indian child, the pilgrims decided to take some of the best things with them. Looting houses, graves, and storage pits was hardly the way to win the trust of the local inhabitants. To help offset the damage they'd already done, they resolved to leave behind some beads and other tokens for the Indians in sign of peace. But it was getting dark. The shallop had returned, and they planned to spend the night back aboard the Mayflower. They must be going. In their haste to depart, they neglected to leave the beads and other trade goods. It would have been a meager gesture, to be sure, but it would have marked their only unmistakable act of friendship since their arrival in the New World. The explorers learned of some good tidings once back aboard the Mayflower. A son, named Peregrine, had been born to Susanna and William White, but a death was soon to follow the baby's birth. Edward Thompson, the White's servant, died on Monday, December 4th. Since Truro's Pamet Harbor was not going to serve their needs, they must find another settlement site. The pilot, Robert Coppin, had a rather hazy memory of a good harbor with a great navigable river about 25 miles across Cape Cod Bay. The reference to a large river suggests that Coppin was thinking of the future site of Boston. There was also talk of a place called Agawam, even farther to the north, known today as Ipswich. After much discussion, it was decided to pick up where they had left off and follow the shoreline of the Cape west and eventually north. Under no circumstances were they to venture beyond the harbor described by Coppin, which he called Thievish Harbor, since an Indian had stolen one of his company's harpoons when he was there several years earlier. For the pilgrims, who had so far stolen a good deal of corn and native artifacts, Thievish Harbor might be just the place. The shallop set out on Wednesday, December 6th. The Mayflower's two pilots, Robert Coppin and John Clark, had replaced Master Jones and were accompanied by the master gunner and three sailors. The pilgrims were represented by Bradford, Carver, Standish, Winslow, John Tilley, and his brother Edward, John Howland, Richard Warren, Stephen Hopkins, and Hopkins's servant, Edward Doty, less than half the number of the previous expedition. Illness and freezing temperatures, it was now in the low 20s, if not colder, had already taken a considerable toll. Almost as soon as they set sail, the salt spray froze on their coats, as if they had been glazed, Bradford wrote. They sailed south into Wellfleet Bay, about 15 miles beyond Truro. On the shore, they saw a dozen or so Indians working around a large, dark object that they later discovered was a pilot whale, a small, bulbous-headed black whale around 20 feet long. Also known as blackfish, pilot whales often become stranded on the tidal flats of the Cape. The Indians were cutting the whale's blubber into long strips when they saw the shallop approaching and fled, running to and fro as if they had been carrying something. Once ashore, the pilgrims built themselves a barricade and a large fire, and as night descended, they noticed the smoke from another fire about 4 miles away. The next day was spent looking for a possible settlement site, with some of them taking to the shallop while others remained on land. Once again, they found plenty of graves and abandoned wigwams, but no people and no suitable anchorages. They determined to sail for Thievish Harbor the following day. Toward nightfall, the shore party rendezvoused with those in the shallop at a tidal creek known today as Herring River. As they had done the previous night, they built themselves a circular barricade of tree trunks and branches with a small opening on the leeward side, where they stationed several sentinels. Around midnight, the silence was broken by a great, hideous cry. The sentinels shouted out, "Arm! Arm!" Several muskets were fired, and all was silent once again. One of the sailors said he'd heard wolves make a similar noise in Newfoundland. This seemed to comfort them, and they went back to sleep. At about 5 a.m., they began to rouse themselves. Most of them were armed with matchlocks, muskets equipped with long, burning wicks that were used to ignite the gun's priming powder. They were not the most reliable of weapons, particularly in the wet and cold, since it was difficult to keep the powder dry. Several men decided to fire off their guns just to make sure they were still in operating order. After prayer, they began to prepare themselves for breakfast and the long journey ahead. In the pre-dawn twilight, some of the men carried their weapons and armor down to the shallop. Laying them beside the boat, they returned to the camp for breakfast. It was then they heard another great and strange cry. One of the men burst out of the trees and came running for the barricade, screaming, "They are men! Indians! Indians!" Suddenly, the air was filled with arrows. Every man reached for his gun. Instead of a matchlock, Miles Standish possessed a snaplock, a predecessor to the flintlock, and immediately fired off a round. The others dipped their matches into the embers of the fire, and with their matches lit, began to blast away. Standish ordered them not to shoot till we could take aim. He didn't know how many Indians were out there in the woods, and they might need every shot. In the meantime, those who had left their muskets beside the shallop sprinted back to retrieve them. The Indians soon had them trapped behind the boat. Standish and those guarding the entrance to the barricade called out to make sure they were unhurt. "Well, well, everyone," they shouted. "Be of good courage." Three of them at the boat fired their muskets, but the others were without a way to light their matches and cried out for a firebrand. One of the men in the barricade picked up a burning log from the fire and ran with it to the shallop, an act of bravery that, according to Bradford, did not a little discourage our enemies. For their part, the Indians' war cries were a particularly potent psychological weapon that the Pilgrims would never forget, later transcribing them as "Woath, watch, ha, ha, hatch, watch." They estimated that there were at least 30 Indians, although some thought that there were many more yet in the dark of the morning. Backlit by the fire, the Pilgrims standing at the entrance of the barricade were easy targets, and the arrows came thick and fast. As the French explorer Samuel Champlain had discovered 14 years earlier on the south coast of Cape Cod, the Indians' bows and arrows were fearsome weapons. Made from a 5.5-foot piece of solid hickory, maple, ash, or witch hazel, and strung with a 3-stranded length of sinew, a native bow was so powerful that one of Champlain's men was skewered by an arrow that had already passed through his dog, making, in effect, a gruesome shish kebab of the French sailor and his pet. The feathered arrows were over a yard long, and each warrior kept as many as 50 of them in a quiver made from dried rushes. With his quiver slung over his left shoulder, and with the hair on the right side of his head cut short so as not to interfere with the bowstring, a native warrior was capable of firing arrows much faster than a musket-equipped Englishman could fire bullets. Indeed, it was possible for a skilled bowman to have as many as 5 arrows in the air at once, and the Pilgrims were forced to take shelter as best they could. There was one Indian in particular, a lusty man and no whit less valiant, who was thought to be their captain. He stood behind a tree within 0.5 musket shot of the barricade, peppering them with arrows as the Pilgrims did their best to blast him to bits. The native leader dodged 3 different gunshots, but seeing one of the Englishmen taking full aim at him, wisely decided to retreat. As fragments of bark and wood flew around him, he let out an extraordinary shriek and disappeared with his men into the woods. Some of the Pilgrims, led no doubt by Standish, followed for about 1/4 mile, then stopped to shoot off their muskets. "This we did," Bradford wrote, "that they might see we were not afraid of them nor discouraged." The clothes they had left hanging on the barricade were riddled with arrows, but none of the men had suffered even a scratch. Before they departed in the shallop, they collected a total of 18 arrows, some headed with brass, others with hart's horn, and others with eagle claws, for eventual shipment back to England. "Thus it pleased God," Bradford wrote, "to vanquish our enemies and give us deliverance." The approximate site of this exchange is still known as First Encounter Beach in Eastham. It could hardly be considered a victory. The Pilgrims knew they could not blast, fight, and kill their way to a permanent settlement in New England. But after the first encounter, it was clear that goodwill was going to be difficult to find here on Cape Cod. It was on to Thievish Harbor. With the wind out of the southeast, they sailed along the southern edge of Cape Cod Bay. Then the weather began to deteriorate. The wind picked up, and with the temperature hovering around freezing, horizontal sleet combined with the salt spray to drench them to the bone. The rough seas made it difficult to steer this wide and heavy boat, and even though the carpenter had labored mightily in preparing the shallop, her rudder did not prove equal to the strain. They were somewhere off the whitish rise of Manomet Bluff, when a wave wrenched the rudder off the transom and the boat rounded up into the wind in a fury of luffing sails and blowing spray. It took 2 men standing in the stern, each clutching a long oak oar, to bring the shallop back around and start sailing once again along the coast. The wind continued to build, and as night came on, the boat became unmanageable in the waves. All seemed lost when the pilot, Robert Coppin, cried out, "Be of good cheer, I see the harbor." By now it was blowing a gale, and in the freezing rain the visibility was terrible. But Coppin saw something, perhaps an inviting darkness between 2 wave-whitened shoals, that convinced him they were about to enter Thievish Harbor. They were running before the wind, with their full mainsail set, bashing through the building seas, when their mast splintered into three pieces. Once they'd gathered up the broken mast and sodden sail,